Hello and welcome to episode 18 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And in this edition, I'm talking to Sophie Bowen, Chief Operating Officer at Middlesex University. We learn about Sophie's career progression from graduate trainee at the University of Birmingham to a current role and what this experience tells us about the place of generalists and specialists within university administration. Looking back at the lockdown experience, we reflect on the extraordinary response of all parts of the university community to addressing the challenges of remote learning and working, and what this means for supporting the health and welfare of staff and students. We also explore the implications for staff and student engagement, learning from innovative practices and the new approach to university meetings, and the skill enhancements required to run them effectively. Finally, we look at the bigger picture, in particular university relationships with government and the challenges which lie ahead for an increasingly diverse sector. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome everyone, and this time on University Registrars Talking About Stuff, it's my great pleasure to introduce Sophie Bowen. Sophie's Chief Operating Officer at Middlesex University. Welcome, Sophie. Really great to talk to you. I wonder if, by way of introduction, we could hear a bit from you about your career history, how you ended up in your lofty position at Middlesex University.
Hi, Paul. Lofty position, that's quite an interesting way to describe it. It certainly feels that way at the moment. I was looking back and I've actually spent 25 years in higher education this September. September 4th, actually. And after a couple of years in charities, I took on a graduate trainee role at the University of Birmingham when those kind of things existed. And after a number of different moves around and up the organisation across all sorts of different areas of professional services, ended up heading up a team of in academic and student administration of all sorts of different aspects of what we do. Took time to have a child. Repositioned my priorities, did an MBA part-time with the Open University, which was fantastic fun.
Yeah.
And then decided it was time for me to take my job seriously and move on. So I was lucky in being appointed to Secretary and Academic Registrar at St George's University of London in Tooting, and spent a good 6 years there, having a fantastic time learning about how wonderful and how complex and how unwonderful medical education, healthcare education is, and the complexities of working with NHS trusts and funding bodies was fantastic. Mm. And also got to have an insight into Kingston University because we had a joint faculty with Kingston. So it was, again, a very interesting time. But after 6 years, time to move on, and 3 years ago was appointed to Chief Operating Officer at Middlesex, which, again, incredibly different institutions. So although I've been in three different institutions, they've all been very different. Russell Group, smaller specialist, and now modern. And there are some interesting parallels and some interesting differences, which have made it quite interesting as a career moving on.
Interesting, as you said. That is a really interesting trajectory because, but it's also whilst everyone is different, you've got that balance between the highly specialist medical area, but also that very generalist introduction to higher education management, both of which I imagine stand you in really good stead in your current role, because you have to deal with both, you know, the broad range of stuff, but also some really specialist stuff too. So do you feel that kind of background has actually prepared you well for your current role?
I think very much so. Having led research teams, policy teams, having had a job in committee secretariat, as we used to call it back in the day, student services, registry, governance, IT, estates, planning, HR, you name it. I've either led teams and pretended to know something about it or done the work myself. So it does give you that sense of breadth of just how complex our organisations are and how things have to work together. So in my current role, where I'm responsible for IT, registry, planning, governance, student legal affairs, and a couple of other small things, it does mean I can join the dots. I can make the connections. Yeah. And it also means I can work with the academic colleagues and understand the language that they're talking and why they're concerned about things, because I've worked closely with faculties over all that time.
No, and I think that that is really important. You're absolutely right. But so do you get a sense of in the sector, people with that kind of career trajectory are you know, in the majority in your and my kind of role? Or I mean, I get the sense that there's a kind of mix now. There's a lot more people coming through very specialist routes, or indeed from outside the sector, from the civil service. And there are perhaps fewer people who've gone that generalist route than there used to be. What's your impression?
I very much share that view. And I think that's partly the world has become more complex. There are many more demands on universities now, from internally and externally. We are large businesses, we always were, but it's more complex. I think it's also a recognition that that specialist knowledge is really needed. We probably also don't do nearly enough in supporting staff to move out of that professional area of expertise, whether that's finance or HR or even generalist administration, and saying, hey, you've got the skills, we can help you move into something else.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right, and something that university administrations have not been terribly good at doing over the years. Now, you could argue, says he, seamlessly linking to the current pandemic situation, that you know there's no time like the present for really testing people in their abilities to take a broad view of university activities. But you could argue also that there's never a worse time to do it. So what's your experience been of the last 4 months? I mean, I get the impression that actually most universities and university communities have responded extraordinarily well to you know, the most challenging of circumstances. But it's been really tough, really hard. What's your experience?
I think you just summarised it very well. You wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy, this kind of thing. Going from what's going to happen, oh, this is a bit worrying, in February, through to suddenly lockdown in March, through to members of the community dying as we had, and then actually trying to keep things going, trying to make sure that students can complete their programs and graduate, that research projects can get completed, and supporting staff. I think as we were talking about it the other day, and I was describing it as, well, you wouldn't, as any organisation, run major initiatives to completely change your timetabling systems, quality assurance, your regulations, your space redesign, pedagogic revolution in all of your programmes, all at the same time, your relationships with staff and students, introducing major new IT systems with 2 months' notice, no planning, no budget, no longer-term strategy. It's a recipe for disaster. But we haven't crashed and burned. Actually, because of the goodwill of our staff, actually, we have managed to thrive and get through this and move into whatever the new reality will be.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. But I think that part of, and it is, I think, extraordinary. And I don't think you know, universities have really had the credit for the way they have responded. But that does present challenges as well, in that, you know, we've got an awful lot of staff who've been working very, very hard for an extended period of time, when normally the nature of the academic cycle would mean that, you know, now they'd be approaching a, you know, a bit of downtime where they could catch up and, you know, do the things they wanted to do and go on holiday as well. So it's and none of that feels wholly possible for everyone at the moment. So how have you been addressing the kind of welfare and health needs of your staff?
Well, I think early on we recognised this would be a significant issue for us, partly because many of our staff travel long distances to get to work. We're in North London. We've got staff, including myself, from Southwest London, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hour commute today. That sense of distance from each other, working from home, is really tricky. So we quite early on we said, adapting from a local NHS trust, we're not working from home. We're at home during a crisis trying to work, and giving people the freedom and the ability to not be logging on 9 to 5 every day, diaries permitting. I've got colleagues who have two under fives sharing the same small flat. How could they do a full day's work? Yeah. Other colleagues who are shielding or for other reasons have not been able to leave the house for 4 months. Actually, that kind of difficult working environment on top of every single aspect of business as usual has to be done in a very different way. It's just incredibly stressful. So the community has actually done a lot. I mean, the university has done as much as we can in terms of flexible working and listening and support and resources. But actually, our community has come into its own. We've got colleagues running online Zumba courses, quizzes, daily fun facts to send around to teams, photo competitions. In fact, I've even joined our sports department has got a sort of keep moving, count your steps thing. And I've even joined that to try and get up to the board a bit, which to get me out of the house doing exercise is quite effective. So I think a lot of it is people working together. What we're at now is a difficult phase because initially it was emergency, all ran it together. Then it was sought out and so many of the different issues. Now people are seeing it's longer term. We've got some staff who probably won't come back next academic year to the university campus for one reason or another. And that does sit quite heavily with a number of people. It's no longer just something that's going to happen. The new normal isn't normal. And so coping with that on top of having no real summer holiday for most, because we're still trying to design next year and work out what 1 meter plus distancing means. And worrying about the next piece of guidance that may or may not come out from one of the regulatory bodies.
Indeed, yes.
All of these mean that it is a very, very different situation. And when everybody's out there, they're looking at people in face masks or not. The world is different outside the world of work, and we have to recognise that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. And if we then, you know, as you say, kind of fast forward a bit and think about our attitudes towards the way colleagues will work in future. I mean, I think it does really shake up, kind of traditional perceptions of working patterns, because they've been so disrupted by this experience that we absolutely have to reconsider the way that we expect people to work. And I mean, you know, particularly as the case you described with the immense distances and experience that people have commuting. I mean, quite reasonably, lots of colleagues will say, I don't want to do that. I can contribute enormously in better and as well as I did before, but I'm, you know, I don't want to be present every single day and don't think I need to be. And I think that in the past we might have been quite dismissive of that kind of thing, or maybe not, and I don't know, but I think we have to adopt a wholly different attitude now, and this, you know, pandemic has shown us that we simply can't go on as we have done.
I think you're right, and I think it is a challenge. It's a challenge for leadership. As you said, there's that, well, if someone's working from home, they're probably not doing much work attitude that we may have had even 3-4 months ago has had to go. And it takes time for people to really think about what the changes might mean for them in terms of their preferences and working together. Online working has been very successful in many places. It's certainly reduced hierarchies. Because you have to get different people together, and that was one of the successes of the first couple of months, actually, that our incident management team was 50 people from all different levels of the organisation meeting at least once a week, and people were encouraged to get involved and take responsibility for things, and that was really fantastic, and we want to keep that attitude going. I think we also had more engagement. Some of our open meetings, we have a new vice chancellor, and so we're putting together what might be our new strategy going forward. So had some open meetings, and the engagement, particularly in terms of numbers, has been much more than you would have had with a face-to-face meeting. Which is really fantastic, and it's encouraged managers to make more time for checking in on people. When you're all physically in the same space, there's less chatting. But there's less how are you really, and how are you coping really. So that's been also positive. There has been some loss of sense of community, and one of our challenges is how we bring that back again and how we allow people to work across the different functional areas, and how we can support people working across those different areas. Because if you haven't got an online meeting with a defined group of people, you're no longer meeting people in the coffee queue. So that's a challenge, I think, going forward.
I think that's an excellent couple of points there. I do think that the loss of the kind of the happenstance, bumping into someone at a meeting or after a meeting or in the corridor. I mean, that's you know, that it just can't happen that way. It seems to me, anyway, in the way that we're structured in the online world. But you're right. The way that people have come together, the turnouts you get at meetings, and also that lack of hierarchy, I think is enormously positive aspect of this. The focus as well on you know, on the matters in hand is good. I mean, whilst there's something to be said for the chatting around a topic when you know you don't have to be out of the room for another half an hour. You know, there is a kind of indulgence in that. But the focus on the matter in hand, I actually rather find quite attractive in shorter time limited meetings. Albeit you get more of the meetings therefore in the day, and it ultimately feels more draining. But I do think the focus is very, very welcome. What thinking again forward a bit then, I mean, do you see when you know, you kind of things return to some semblance of normality, you know, later in the academic session, I mean, will you ever have normal face-to-face meetings like you used to have, or do you think you'll go for a hybrid model, or do you think you'll go for some meetings always on Teams or Zoom? How do you think it'll pan out for formal university meetings?
I think it'll change over time. I think there will be a hybrid model for some time. So we're talking in our executive team this morning actually about how long we keep doing online once we're all back on campus, and say, well, actually online works in most cases. And our board meetings have been running online and largely quite successful as well, and having more of those because of the crisis. So I think we'll end up next academic year a hybrid, and actually we have the technology in Middlesex to have some people in the room and some people not. So there's a whole new dynamic around how you chair and control and discuss when you've got some people on the other end of a computer and others not. We have some experience because of our overseas campuses in doing some of that work, but we're going to be doing quite a bit more of that.
No, we've got that as well, but I do think it's really very much harder. You can do it with two on the screen, but when you've got more than half a dozen on the screen and half a dozen in the room, I personally find it really, really hard to navigate that, because you've got to switch so rapidly from one to the next. It's very, very difficult. But I will be interested to learn more, Sophie, from your experiences, because I'm hopeless at it.
Well, do you know what? It actually makes it makes the role of chairing and participating in a meeting much more focused. Because you have to make that effort to look around the table to make sure people have an opportunity to contribute. It's a bit like if you're having a large meeting online and you've got a chat bar going at the side and you're trying to keep an eye on the faces and who's got their hand up. Yeah. It's harder work to chair. And so I think there's some skills development activity that we can all do to move that forward. And it's relevant for the it's relevant in the teaching area as well. I mean, trying to have a Zoom class with 30, 40 students, it's a very different skill set. And so one of the challenges going forward will be around this kind of organizational digital maturity and resilience in supporting this kind of activity. Because online teaching will continue, not just the next 3-6 months, but potentially longer term as we look at different ways of delivering and supporting teaching and learning.
Yes, I'm absolutely sure you're right there. Going again, looking forward, how are your preparations for the start of session? We're talking at the end of July. We're all universities are planning for how things are going to be in September, October. But there is also, we're doing this at a time when the government is currently encouraging everyone to, as they put it, get back to work. But there is a kind of a narrative within our sector which says that universities really shouldn't be doing this at all, and that actually we should all be sticking to online provision, or at the very least critiquing all the steps that have been made public that universities are trying to grapple with at the moment, and being quite challenging in terms of the how students are going to respond to the ways we're hoping to operate. I wonder what thoughts you've had at Middlesex about that start of session and how you're going to manage when large numbers of students return.
I agree with you in terms of the external environment and the sort of the 2-week honeymoon period that higher education had, because we were helping solve all the problems of dealing with the immediate response, is well and truly over. And quite rightly, there's lots of questions being raised around, will students be the new epicentres, universities be the new epicentres of second and third waves, student expectations around what they get for their fees, staff and their ability to adjust to whatever the new normal is quite concerning. We have been battling our way, as everybody else has, through the weekly changing expectations and approaches. So we will be doing our induction activities and our pre-arrival activities online, but doing many more of them. We'll then be having some teaching on campus if we don't have second or third lockdowns or waves, but focused on those activities which are very difficult to do in an online environment. So, for example, some of the engineering laboratories and so on, and supporting our students being able to come and study on campus or access the library under certain restrictions or get employability help. So trying to create an environment, but also making sure that we don't have all 18,000 students on campus at the same time, which is one of the difficulties and one of the challenges. And it could go two ways. It could either go first couple of weeks a bit difficult, and then people are back and it's all back to normal and we're all just wearing face masks. Or it could go a couple of weeks and then everything gets very, very difficult. We end up having to go back to fully online and we don't know. And that's one of the complexities, the continual level of uncertainty in not just the progression of COVID itself, but the way we need to be responding to it as responsible employers and people who really want our students to succeed, but we also don't want to put them under any threat, yeah, is really quite tricky.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right there. And, you know, allied to that is the you know, preparation for response should there be a local outbreak, or should, you know, your local area become, you know, a hotspot and you're locked down. But I think our instant responses have all been sharpened up over the past few months, so I'm sure you'll be ready for anything.
I think the incident response thing. You're absolutely right. The incident response, I think, will be coping. I think the difficulty is knowing how our students will react. Over 60% of our students are commuting students from all over North London and into Hertfordshire and so on. We don't know yet if they're going to be prepared to get on the Northern Line. It's bad enough at the best of times, but in this environment, it's interesting. So we won't really know until we get back on campus how things will feel, look, and manage.
There's an awful lot of uncertainty about student behaviour of all sorts. You know, international students, will they arrive? Local students, as you say, will they get onto public transport? Will they be willing to travel? I think the other, there's been a lot of talk, of course, of testing regimes, etc. One of the things that we will all need to test is what the mood is of that student body on a regular basis. And, you know, I think understanding where they're coming from will be hugely important to how we respond to, you know, whatever circumstances arise. And I think that's really important, but really quite difficult to do, to kind of gauge that sentiment on a pretty frequent rolling basis.
You're absolutely right. And I think it does change the dynamic between the student body and universities in a way that perhaps we haven't had before, even when we were, you know, introducing the new fees regime a few years ago. It's students quite rightly are paying for a university experience that is going to be very different next year and probably the year after. So the role of student unions in being that kind of voice of students, the role of student representatives, are incredibly important. We did a survey of our existing students in April, May time, and got a good response rate. And they were generally very positive. But every time you ask students for their views on things, there will be 25 different views and 25 other things that they suggest you do better. So yeah. It's not just asking the students for how they're engaging, but it's then actually which of those things do you take forward and how do you develop?
And that's part of the fun and challenge of working in a university environment, of course, is that there is that kind of constant critique of what you're doing, to which you have to respond and identify the priorities that you're going to address and accept that not everyone's going to be happy all the time. But on the whole, you're trying to do the right thing and just hope that it lands well and that you do it safely and securely.
Absolutely. And it comes back to communication, which, again, you could never communicate enough by as many different channels as possible. And we're trying to do that at the moment, but there will always be students that you can't reach, or staff members you can't reach, or local community you can't reach. One of the things we are doing is we've got a sort of innovation group who are pulling together all of the learning that we're experiencing through this pandemic and our response to it, and where we can do things differently in the future. We're trying to pull those together, both to fit into our longer term strategy, but also like the points we were saying earlier about the working from home environment continuing. How can we make that better? How can we pull it together? So it's quite a fun group to be part of.
Yeah, oh, that's excellent. Excellent idea. Okay, thinking a bit more broadly then, and there's been a lot of talk as part of the discussion around the government's support package for universities and its recent publication of the information about how universities that found themselves in particular financial difficulty could access additional support beyond the existing support out there. But that, of course, comes with huge strings and caveats about the business planning and how universities in that position engage with government. And I mean, it puts them in a very, very difficult position, it seems to me. But what's your thinking about how the sector is going to look in a few years' time? I mean, do you think that lots of universities will go for that kind of lots of strings supports package in order to survive? Or do you think we'll have voluntary mergers? Or do you think some universities will simply go under? How do you think it's going to play out?
It's interesting because we could all play the sort of the guessing game of where things will go. And I think one thing is perhaps I don't think we have one sector anymore, if we ever did. I think the breadth of different types of institutions, independent as well as traditional, large, small, specialist, small providers in cities who are private providers, we don't have one sector anymore. And I think that's one of the complexities going forward, because although we have sector bodies, it's recognised in government that there isn't one sector, and therefore there is the ability to, it's harder to present a view of the value of higher education for research, for education, for the future of the country, because there are so many different views. So will we have people taking advantage of the regime? Well, that will be up to individual institutions. What perhaps is more interesting is the direction of travel in terms of government moving HE into the same kind of controlling area as FE. We've seen with the OFS, we've seen with DfE getting involved in lots of things, that the relationship between government and higher education is shifting, and that independence, that autonomy is, and I won't say the word undermined, because actually there are positive bits to this as well, but there is much more active engagement in what higher education should be, and that is driving some of these initiatives to save you, but you've got to do everything we say from that point on. Narrative, which is in part there. So I think what's going to be very interesting is going to be, regardless of what flavour governments we have into the future, whether this trajectory continues, and whether that starts to really push universities in particular directions.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very good point. I do think, I mean, you're absolutely right in terms of the greater degree of intervention, the desire to steer and direct higher education in a particular way. I have to say, though, I think it's a you know, a staggeringly underinformed view about what higher education is actually like. I mean, go back to your earlier point about it not really being one sector, and being, you know, various different kinds of offering within a very, very broad higher education landscape. I mean, most of the views of the people that are commenting on higher education from government and from ministry seem to be very deeply coloured by their experience in Oxford College quads, rather than a broader view of the nature of higher education in this country. And I think that's really, really worrying. And also, it's, you know, kind of 20 years out of date as well. The focus on issues around you know, free speech and students' unions and things is really quite misguided in terms of where the challenges to higher education actually lie, and what government could do to support higher education. So my concern would be that intervention turns out to be, you know, not just challenging to institutional autonomy, which is, you know, fundamentally undermines the strength of higher education and its delivery of quality education and research, but actually, you know, runs entirely counter to the priorities of the nation as well, and ends up damaging that which it's meant to protect. And I think that would be deeply, deeply sad. But that's a very pessimistic view, and I think you were probably being a little bit more optimistic than that, Sophie.
I was trying to be optimistic because change happens. But I think you're absolutely right. There is no long-term strategy for how higher education, not just the undergraduate degree, but everything about higher education, feeds into the future of the country. What's the 10 to 20 year plan? Because that's what you need to pull and make policy levers that are effective. What we've got at the moment is policy levers driven in part by things like National Student Survey and continuation rates and all those kind of things that do demonstrate some areas of complexity in some parts of the non-sector, but also driven by what some of the media decides to focus on, which is evidence-based on small stories from students or from others. And that drives the rhetoric, and that's not going to change. What needs to change is making sure that those in government have the evidence base of the value of higher education, of what we do, of how we contribute to local communities, how we contribute to the research of the country, how we contribute to individual futures as well as the workforce of the country. That's what's missing, or if it's there, it's certainly not getting enough airplay.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, that's a challenging set of actions for our sector. And on that note, then, Sophie, we'll have to stop. But thank you ever so much for a really engaging and wide-ranging discussion. Thanks again.
Thank you too, Paul.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course. And if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.